With John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Welcome to John Bowd's All the Rage here on www.traxfm.org. How you doing? John's been having quite a few interviews of late, because there's lots to talk about, and there's people out there that want to talk about it and want to come on Trax FM. So. But we're back in our normal routine, and this week myself and John will be talking about a number of things. How you doing, John?
Yeah, pretty good, mate. It seems a bit odd to actually have myself back on the air doing a you and me show. We've had so many interviews in a row, but we'll see what we can come up with. I've got to be honest, I've got a big show I'm writing at the moment, but I haven't finished writing it. So we'll touch on a couple of those issues, I think, tonight. But yeah, we're gonna freeform a bit, aren't we? God help us.
Well, it will be on a few of my favourite subjects. it's odd. I was looking. I know we were going to talk about Thatcher, Mrs. Thatcher, to Conservative voters. And I was just checking about the release of the documents that are coming out on her tenure, which was in the National Archives. Now, this is really weird, John. I found this really weird. Up until 2005, the release of information to the National Archives was at the moment, most government dealings, the papers aren't released. That's a 30-year rule. And even then, it was before, up until 2005, even then it wasn't released. And what happened, the new Labour government in the House of Commons, and they had a huge majority in the House of Commons, passed through the Freedom of Information Act. And so from 2005, the 30-year rule was literally the 30-year rule. And since then, 80% of government dealings in the past are now available to the general public, but I think there was some from 1958 there'd been, you know, attempts to get information released from 1958, and some of the stuff about the IRA meetings. I know the National Archives released information about Mrs. Thatcher meeting with them through a backstop. I've also read, I don't know, I couldn't find any information on Ted Heath, John Major, Harold Wilson, Jim Callaghan, Tony Blair, and Jeremy Corbyn and Mo Mollem, as obviously well documented, incorrectly in regards to Mr. Corbyn. Because it's a lie. He only dealt with them as when they were Sinn Féin as a political, when they had a political arm.
Yeah.
He never actually dealt with them as the IRA. Yes, we all know Sinn Féin was the political arm of the IRA. But if we look at the big picture, but again, I think people are talking about what they read in the mainstream media. So there was a picture of someone yesterday. Put up a picture of a bloke in a beard at Bobby Sands' funeral in 82, excuse me. So I had to correct them because someone put an arrow. And I'm sorry to say this, but it was on a gammon. I know it's a popular word, but this site that I saw it on was a gammon site. And it was an arrow saying Jeremy Corbyn at Bobby Sands' funeral. And I had to correct them and I said, no, that's Bob Corran. Not Jeremy Corbyn. Bob Corran was Bobby Sands' press agent.
But have you ever seen the two of them in the same room together? Is my question to you.
It didn't look anything like Corbyn. It was a bloke with a beard. So I had to correct them. And they call me a Corbyn knob. So it's good to have an intelligent debate, John. Take it away, John. Well, sorry, I'm taking over.
No, please. You brought up some very interesting points there for me to talk about. I mean, the issue of social media and people's interactions on it, I don't really know what to say in a way, because we say so much and we say so little about the way that people do interact in this environment, and it absolutely is a hotbed for promoting conspiracy theories and just basically shitposting, as they call it, just doing stuff for the sake of winding people up or whatever, which it was on internet forums when they first came around, but they weren't as popular, so they were noticed. They didn't have the same effects. You've got someone like you have, who's basically trying to start something with a ridiculous photograph they're claiming is Jeremy Corbyn right next to a photo of the Turin Shroud or something like that, which they're convinced is sent here by aliens or whatever. And how do you respond? Well, I mean, the natural inclination to respond is just to go, well, this bloke's a dick, and dismiss it. But the weird thing is, in the world that we live in now, in the kind of media that we have now, it seems to hang around. It's because somebody can make something out of it. And one of the biggest problems here, and I think we've seen this in a lot of the anti-Semitism discussions we've had around Labour and that, is in no way, I mean, it seems like you have to say this and that and this and that, and it, in no way does it minimise any actions of anti-Semitism, because actions of anti-Semitism are appalling. But yeah, it seems weird that I feel like, despite having without blowing my own horn, a pretty provable record of acting against racism of all kinds, as you have yourself, as we have within our union, it seems like you need to say that all the time before you then, talk about some criticisms you have of it. One of the criticisms I have of it is just quite obviously, as is not controversial to say, as all things in politics do, some people have made something out of this. And yes, some of those people will be Zionists, who, again, it's, you get into murky water, but we're talking about Zionism and anti-Zionism. But really, why is water murky? Pretty much, and look, this is not a scientific poll, this is people I know, but pretty much every Jewish person, not quite everyone, but the vast majority of them, would describe themselves as anti-Zionist. There's no controversy in calling themselves that. Absolutely none. I would describe myself as that because, having studied the situations of what's going on in Palestine, having visited there, I see an apartheid state. And I see a group of people whose belief system, nothing to do with their ethnicity, nothing to do with their religion, the belief system they have chosen is one to form a country that acts as an ethno-apartheid state. Now, I've said all of that, I've put my position on the line, then we come to the other issue. And this also goes to another one of my attitudes towards social media in general. I don't care if anyone finds that offensive. I'm not being a prick about it, because I'm not going out of my way to be offensive, which people can do that, they have the freedom to do that. What no one ever talks about when they talk about the freedom to offend is why you would bother. And usually, if you've got the freedom to offend, that's one thing. I've also got the freedom to point out that you're a sad, attention-seeking little twit as you get a life, which most of these people are like that, especially on social media. But at the same time, if someone's offensive or horrible to you on social media, I don't really care. I don't know if I put that, I don't mean to put that in a very upspeak, young person's manner. But do you know what I mean, Dave? It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean,
if someone's rude to you, I don't fucking care.
I think we have to put things into perspective. So if we look at the current people on television who are paid to say things, and they have to be controversial or they won't be hired.
It's part of the media game.
It is. So Piers Morgan, Katie Hopkins, all la-di-da of these people, I don't know who they are, but if they came on and said, look, we all got to be nice to each other, they're never going to be hired again. And they know that the more people who are into socialism and the young people, it's the young people they're targeting, because they're the ones that are going to get a rise out of it. They're the ones who react. They're the ones who make their Twitter thing go crazy. You get nothing out of the over 50s. I promise you get nothing apart from silly things. You'll only get a debate from the young people. And I think these people say things to get it moving. And then they're hired for the next show, Look, yeah. I'm from an age where we laugh at things. I'm from a minority or ethnic minority, and I think the West Indians, we just laughed at people, So just for example, before people say, oh, it's Dave and John, you can't say anything and get offended about it. We don't. Me and John joke about lots of things, but just in your defence, John, and I'll say it, there is not one atom in John's body that is racist of anything. I'm putting my hand up here. Not one atom. John?
Yes, so listen to that, people. Then my token ethnic minority friend has now said, so far from me. So if any of you say otherwise, I'm going to wave him at you and go, nah! Shut up, Whitey. I don't know. It's funny enough, mate, because it's one of the things I've often wanted to talk about on the show, but I don't really know. It's only because, purely on a basis of inarticulation on my part. To just kind of, you know, these ideas. Okay, I'll tell you part of what it comes down to this. These ideas of being polite. It's, I mean, look, we all like being polite to each other. This is why, you know, I have some people, even hardened conservative scum like Peter Hitchens, says I have a, you know, quite a benign attitude towards the ideas of political correctness, because ultimately it comes down to just people polite to each other. And I think most of us would rather live in that world. If I was tread on your foot coming out of the front door of a shop or whatever, I was like, oh, I'm very sorry, mate, I didn't mean to do that. You know, please and thank you. That's the kind of world we want to live in. But we live in that world because we want to. The idea that when dealing with people who do, say, stand for appalling things, or whose actions are appalling, and, you know, we're under this great compulsion, especially those of us on the left, we seem to be under a great compulsion to be really polite and not attack these people in a personal way. Now, let me advance on what that means. See, where you might say not to attack somebody personally, and yeah, look, I've got no time for someone like Anna Soubry, but I don't want to see someone, you know, running up to her outside Parliament screaming traitor in her face, because we know what that means. We saw what happened to Jo Cox. We saw what the white supremacist who murdered her was, you know, saying, death to traitors, Britain first. You know, I don't want to see that happen to even a Tory. Beyond that, you know, the idea that you can, they seem to have this weird idea that if you look at into anything they've said or done, if you look at people's voting record, if you bring things up, if you say, for instance, let me give you an argument. I was going to talk about the independence group at some point, but TIG, as they're also known, Anna Soubry is one of the many people who's a part of that group, or they call Change something, I can't remember anyway, who cares. They're going to be Liberal Democrats before the end of the year anyway. So they were. And she was saying something about how we do politics differently now. It's not about policy. It's about it's about values. Well, sorry, is that not identity politics? That thing that so many people have been slagging off, particularly from the conservative side. You know, that so many people over, the types of people like you said, over 50, who I'm surprised can work the computer, that they can't stand any kind of identity politics. They can't stand this, us, you know, us disabled black gay people coming up and saying that those are important parts of our identity and stuff like that. So all of a sudden you're talking about values or identity politics. And coming back to the point of why I'm saying this, no, Miss Soubry or anyone else, not values, it's the shit you vote for. That's why we don't like. I don't like Anna Soubry because she voted for austerity, which I think has not only made people's lives miserable, it was actually resulted in some people's death. She voted for the bedroom tax. You know, she voted for all of these hardcore anti-poor people, anti-working class policies, which were enacted by the governments that she has been a part of and have had real-world terrible effects on people. Now, A, that's why I don't like you, and B, who gives a fuck if I'm polite to you when I tell you that? Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I've looked at the whole thing about left and right and policies and stuff like that, and I have to say, looking at the debacle of current now, and I'm thinking, God, have we been listening to that all my life? Is that what we've been doing? Where have I been? I look at their arguments and it doesn't address anything that's happening here. And I'm really sorry for anyone over 50 who believes that the politics we've been looking at is the professional politics. That's how you should be, a real statesman. Look at that. Look at that. Look at this. He's got the tie on. He speaks really well. He's really educated. That's my Prime Minister. Sorry, got it wrong.
So this idea of, I completely agree with you, it's completely about appearance. The idea of statesman, what the fuck is a statesman? So I've heard people say, oh, Winston Churchill was a great statesman. Was he a great statesman when he was fucking starving people to death in Bengal? Was he a great statesman when he was saying he wanted to wipe out Japan?
No, it's a certain element in our society that's come up through the 40s and 50s that believe, he was being British.
That's the problem. He was being an arsehole.
And I think once we get into these books, get into the internet, look at the Burma famine, the potato famine, colonisation, foreign policy, whose benefit are these politicians working for? So we look at that debacle, and I'm sorry to tell people, that's how it's always been.
Yeah.
So a politician makes a... I always look at a politician that says, I'm going to make a decision. I've got the consensus to do something, but I've thought it through. I thought about, because politicians should be that. They should be looking 10 steps ahead about society. Is it divided? If I make a decision, will it divide society? Divide society? How are we dealing with ethnic minorities, the most vulnerable? Will it affect them before I make this decision? That, to me, is a politician. And so I want people to look in their books and their history books and see if we've had a politician to do that. We all have some idea of a politician or a prime minister. We do. So we have an idea about Mrs. Thatcher. So Mrs. Thatcher was tough and strong, and she was the Iron Lady. And we look at that, and I say, you mean she promoted Britishness? Yes. That's what makes Mrs. Thatcher people's prime minister. She was strong. She took on the unions. She didn't take any nonsense. Well, in actual fact, if you read her book and if you look at the Freedom of Information Act and the stuff that's coming out, she had a cabinet of paedophiles. She didn't really champion women in politics because none of her cabinet were women, ever. And she never promoted any women in. She never did anything for women. Apparently she was a bit touchy-feely, which is reports are coming out. There's handwritten notes that have come out that from the National Archives, remember I spoke about it before, handwritten notes saying that she's well aware that most of her cabinet are paedophiles. So, you know, that's politics, and we have to look at that. Do we really, you know, John?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, I do love that when people say things like, this person was quite nice behind the scenes. Well, being on the receiving end of their political decisions was where the rest of us were at, so I couldn't give a shit if they were nice to puppies. I mean, this, what a ridiculous thing to say, you know, as if that actually mattered. But again, you see, it's relying on the personal, it's relying on the, I think it was Ellie Mae O'Hagan actually on Twitter had a brilliant thing the other day when we're, you know, thinking of all these criticisms that we have now of politics, especially in Labour, being about personalities. It's all being about Corbyn, this, that, the other. And she'd found an old copy of the Labour 1997 election manifesto with a massive close-up picture of the face of Tony Blair. And she put it up on Twitter and said, yeah, it's great we don't live in a world where politics is just about personalities anymore. You know, I mean, so, yeah, they're kind of marching. And like you say, you know, leadership qualities is being firm and hard and non-moving and just basically shitty to people. Aside, that's not my idea of good leadership. The other thing that's worth mentioning about, because I was reminded of this recently, I was reading a book I was reading. Another one the things that is worth remembering about Margaret Thatcher is that, especially in the early part of her prime ministerial career, she didn't succeed by her own measures. For as far as economic growth and stuff like that was concerned, Joe, don't believe me, go and look at the numbers. They didn't do that well. And then what was the actual effect? Well, they just sold everything off. And then here we are today. I mean, it's funny because as soon as you mention something like this, Dave, it opens up in my brain like four different, like on the internet, four different windows for separate radio shows. Oh, yeah, we should cover that. We should cover that. I don't know how you do it. It's just one of those people.
Well, no, it's just, I always take my attitude of say, well, that's what we got. That's what we have. And I'm not offended by it. If you say Corbyn's an idiot, then you believe Corbyn's an idiot. But
yeah, but why do you believe it?
Well, the press have made out that he's different.
Yeah, exactly.
He's different. He's anti-British. He hates everything British. I have not seen any evidence of that whatsoever. He deals with terrorists. Well, I've just given you information, documented information. National Archive files that say the most strongest prime minister, and some believe, was actually dealing with them through the MI5. So it's not true. What I'm saying is, let's reevaluate how we've done things in the past. I'm not saying rip it up. History is important. Good, bad or indifferent, it's important. But how we do things differently. Now, it's interesting, there was a poll today, a number of polls that said, that asked under 30s, would you vote for Conservative Party? A huge percentage of them didn't even know who they were. A huge percentage didn't know what the Troubles were in Ireland. A huge percentage didn't know who Margaret Thatcher was. And pretty much 100% of them didn't know what happened in the Falklands, or even know where it is. So
around about the same as the people that were around when the fucking war broke out.
Yeah.
They've invaded off the coast of Scotland. No.
No, you're asking a group of people that have totally different problems now. We've got online bullying. We've got no services, youth services. The playing fields are getting sold off. There's no job. There's no window. There's no pot to piss in and no window to throw it out from. We got the rise of food banks. Yeah, you could say you're talking all the shit. That's fine. You probably don't have the problems that most people have in this country then. Good luck to you. Congratulations. But as I said, when you sit next to someone with these issues, it's real. We're going to take a music break. We'll be right back.
John Bouts, all the rage, all the on Tracks FM, Tracks FM, Tracks FM.
We'll be right back.
See, that was John's not hearing the music, but that was Erasure sometimes.
I did hear it, actually.
Which is was regarded in my part of the world when I was growing up, Erasure, as Batty Boys and blah, blah, blah. And I mentioned in the previous show the West Indian community, and certainly the Asian community, have a long way to go in regards to LGBT. And I'm able to criticise myself from that, or criticise my ethnicity. I'm allowed to do that. We are allowed to laugh as well at each other, which we do. John?
Yeah, that's an interesting. I'm going to bridge into that in a minute. I just wanted to make a couple of things, so to kind of close off a bit of the last thing we were talking about. Sorry for me being pernickety, listeners, but I like to feel like I've come to some kind of conclusion and like I've communicated something that I think or believe. You'd have to be the judge of that, but don't write to us because I don't care. Firstly, I just want to make something very clear. When I'm before, when we were talking about online people mouthing off to each other, that in no way dismisses online bullying. I mean, as a person, and particularly as a trade union activist, I'm fiercely anti-bullying. That's especially for the way that the young people are treated. And I think it's wrong for us oldies to kind of assume that you can just log off. I mean, you're absolutely right. I can just log off, but I live in a different world. And especially for the world, not only just coming out of school, but going into the world of work now, young people live in a far more terror, almost disintegrating by the day level of insecurity. I mean, I'd refer you to our episode 49 from the other week of when we spoke to Adam Badger. He had some incredibly important things to say about that. I'm not saying this about bullying, but at the same time, the idea of I think it comes from the same place where people have such utter contempt for the rest of us, they would impose policies like austerity when their friends in the city fuck up and waste loads of money, in the same way that they kind of dismiss you as going, oh well, this is just a personal attack. And my point there is, no, it isn't necessarily. Okay, I might not be the most articulate person, and my language would be something that would make my nan blush in her era. But, I was like that when I was a kid too, to be fair. But I have a problem with you because of your policies. I have a problem with you because what you've done in the world of politics in your career. And that includes the right of the Labour Party too. I mean, some of the people that have left in the TIG group, I'm so happy to see the back of them. I want them to take more people with them, actually. I want them to take Hillary Benn and Jess Phillips and all these other people I can't bear. I don't want to be in the same party as them. And piss off to the glorified Liberal Democrats, which is what you are now. We're the group that we're never actually sure what their purpose and point is, and they've never told us who funds them. But that's for another week. So I just wanted to clarify that. Just quickly though, Dave, just as a quick side note on the subject of jokes, I often have this discussion with people where they say about what makes a joke racist or something or homophobic or whatever. And by no means is this a hard and fast rule, but generally speaking, it's the person who tells it. It's an example being the one you love, Bernard Manning. He used to tell a joke about the fella who's, you know how this joke goes. It's the one where they say, if the police pick you up, you say, if they say, you know, anything you say will be taken down in evidence, and you immediately say, please don't hit me again, officer. Or if you're black, you say, please don't hit me again and again and again. Now, depending on how you tell that joke, that's a gag. I see it as about police brutality. It's a very, very dark joke, laughing at a problem that, again, we most certainly still have. But, I mean, you remember, Dave, you know, sort of the 60s, 70s and 80s, where police brutality towards ethnic minorities especially was almost a given. You know, it was a common occurrence. So it's a very dark joke about that. When Bernard tells it to a room full of policemen, as he was secretly recorded back in the early 90s doing so, a policeman's special meeting or whatever, well, no, he tells a joke and it's full of N-words. And it's all about making out that the victim is an idiot and a scumbag. And then he goes off into a thing about how, you know, if you're a dog born in a stable, it doesn't make you a fucking horse and all this kind of stuff, which isn't a joke. It's racial intolerance. So to answer, I mean, that's a top example to me to answer that question about what makes a joke racist. Well, that talentless fat prick telling it would be the main thing that makes it racist.
Well, I saw it was incredibly there was a sort of mid-70s or late-70s chat show with Esther Ranson in it. And this is when it was acceptable. You know, you had Love Thy Neighbour and Mind Your Language and things, which I didn't find. You know, they were very popular with ethnic minorities, those programmes. Anyway.
Well, it was being recognised.
Yeah. It was, yeah. But she challenged him at that time, live on telly. She challenged him.
Oh, yeah, I've seen this.
It's yeah, she found him quite offensive, and she told him on live telly. It was on...
Yeah.
She said, you know...
I think it was Parkinson or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, it was something like Parkinson or something. And she challenged him on that. She found him, his jokes, quite offensive. And it's weird because as the 80s rolled on, he was getting interviewed more and more, not necessarily about his jokes, he was getting interviewed more and more about his offensiveness. But I think the problem is that some people did get offended by that because they felt that their ability to not be able to talk about it. So if I came out and I lived in Oldham or Luton and I was Caucasian and I said, look, this street's totally changed from when I was growing up, you know, and I'm not being racist, they want to say it, and then you have to have the healthy debate with them and say, well, actually, a lot of people that actually moved out, gone abroad, more people are moving out of the country than actually coming in figures, really, I'm telling you, it's a fact. And things are just changing, you know, but they're, you know, and then we have that debate. I think some people felt that they couldn't say it, and then it's gone totally the other way, John. Do you get what I mean? And they get offended because they can't talk about it.
I do. There's some hugely important points, I think, to make on that, though. Starting with, firstly, bringing us back to where we started, in which part of my point at the beginning was criticism of Israel and even criticism of some elements of international, you know, diaspora culture of Jewish people or anybody else doesn't automatically confer anti-Semitism. So how do you know if people might be in this way? Well, by tropes. Rothschild and Jews with Money and George Soros and stuff like those are tropes. Now, and they're absolutely, they're right, they're things that should be pounced on and shut down. But they don't just exist within the Jewish community, they exist for other communities too. So coming back to what you've just said, you might very well look up a street and go, yeah, this has changed a lot since I was a kid. But I have a couple of questions. Okay, firstly, the reason, maybe this isn't always explained very well, the reason people might feel their heckles up a little bit about that is because that is a trope. It doesn't necessarily mean you mean that when you say it. You might just be making an observation. But, you know, policies that were put forward by the likes of the National Front were, your streets are changing, all these foreigners are coming in and they're changing your culture. Quite a lot of Indian people, Southern Asian, I should say, people did change this country. Consequently, we've got good food now. You know, along with them and the Italians and the Chinese and Eastern Europeans, we've actually got edible food, which we never had in the 50s. So you do have to watch out for that being, that's what makes me nervous about it, is whether or not I'm hearing an anti-immigration trope. Secondly, this town has changed a lot, or this city's changed a lot since I was a kid. You know, shit, Sherlock, did you think it was just going to fucking sit still for 50 years? You know, do you not realise you're an old bastard and obviously things have changed? I mean, again, this comes to this whole thing about, I'd be interested to hear from listeners on this. Am I being cold-hearted when I say I don't give a shit if the pub down the road closes down? You know, let's say there's loads of pubs closing all over the place. Well, yeah, maybe young people have got better things to do. I mean, living out in the suburbs where we live, I remember talking to my cousin in a conversation about this, and he said for the life of him, you know, being near a train station, which is 40 minutes away from London, for the life of him, he couldn't imagine why people on a Saturday night would go to the local pub. You know, why not go uptown? And being intolerant about it, I can see where he's coming from, and actually I share his view. I think, well, if you live in the town that I live in, I just think, like, why would you want to stay here any longer than you have? If you're going to stay here on a Saturday night and you stay indoors and, you know, watch a DVD, or you go out and you go up somewhere interesting, why would you want to stay provincial? And the fact is, there's just a difference of mindset here. And ultimately, I don't want to sound too outreachy and hippie here. We need to learn to live with each other on that front. But it's not the likes of you and me, the younger and the younger generations that need to change, because they're far more open-minded and cool about this. It's older people who seem to think of everything. I mean, again, I'm happy to hear opposing views on this, but seem to see everything as some kind of threat. Oh, anything new, anything different, anything a different colour. And just in closing on that, talking about old footage, somebody I know showed me a really interesting bit of old footage from Southall in the... It's old news footage, I think. I think it's from the 60s or the early 70s, with a lot of Indian people moving in. They're talking to a lot of the white people there, and they're going, well, I don't like it here. There's too many Indians. I'm going to move. Yeah, I'm moving out of here. Okay. That was your decision, though. You decided to move someplace else. And by the way, have you done really, really badly from moving to from Southall to Wembley to Ruislip to, you know, whatever else, further afield? Yeah, so what are you complaining about? But, you know, this, I really resent that, though, because the idea that people like you were chased out of here. You weren't chased out of here. You decided, for your own prejudicial reasons, you didn't want to live near people of a darker skin tone than you, so you chose to move. Take some fucking responsibility for your actions.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if the mainstream media throw in a dose of fear, which, you know, fear is... once you transmit fear... It's interesting about Southall, because I'm a second generation ethnic minority Asian, and I spoke to a second generation Asian from Southall back in the day, and he said it's not the same. There's all Somalians there, so
that's integration for you, mate. That's a problem.
Yeah, but he his view was quite... He didn't mean it, but it wasn't based on mainstream media of... So currently the mainstream media, or for a while, has said that there's a bunch of marauding Muslims coming over to change everything to Sharia law. That scares people. It's obviously not true, it's crap. But it scares people. It really does. And you throw a bit of dose of fear and make people actually look at their street, how it's changed. You throw in a dose of fear like that, and it comes out with some bizarre things people say, you know.
Yeah.
As I said, I think fear, it's, once you transmit it, it spreads like wildfire, and people come out with the daftest thing. Because the papers said it.
Exactly, but it's the other thing I've got to... I've got to ask the question, though. When people look at this situation, when people say... there were rumours for a long time going around about Rotherham grooming gangs and stuff like that. And I knew about it. You know, we used to talk about it in the pub all the time or whatever. If you really did know about these things, why were you sitting in the pub? Why weren't you doing anything? And when people say, there's a mass of people coming over here trying to change the culture directly to something that is dangerous and associated with terrorism and enslaving people. If you really believe that, why are you indoors? Why are you not out in the street? Why are you not, this is part of the problem I have with that kind of intolerance. Not just that I hate intolerance anyway, but to be honest with you, mate, I don't believe a lot of the people who say it believe it. It's just it's kind of an excuse for something else. And when you push it to its farthest reaches, that's when you get into David Icke territory of that our rulers are all aliens. And if you look at a lot of those theories, they're sometimes based on stuff which is true about, elitism, normally based on how much money you've got or what industry you work in, and the ability for the 1% to harvest so much of the money and income that's generated, and the rest of us don't get it, and we have to face austerity and all that. And you think, well, yeah, that's accurate. And there are very detailed, as you've pointed out on a couple of things tonight, very factual, well-detailed concepts and explanations for why those things happen, part of the banking system, or part of how it works, or part of decisions that governments make. But no, because I feel like I'm disempowered and I can't do anything. And it's very important to talk about how people feel disempowered. There's another reason why sometimes it's easier to target a politician you don't like and say, you're just a wanker and I hate you, rather than go for a point-by-point explanation of why you don't like them, which I've done, by the way, only to then be, you know, have the same politician write back to me and effectively call me a wanker. So, you know, you think, what's the point? You know, shout out Philip Davis MP. If you, I doubt you remember me, but you and I had a very interesting tete-a-tete via email about 6 or 7 years ago. Anyway, sorry, that's a side issue. Yeah, it's much easier to go, no, I've got no power and I can't do anything about this. Why? Because the people who are doing this are aliens. You know, they're lizard people. They're some, you know, that's where it gets to the, and it's weird that the kind of lizard people thing is like, you can see it, if you like, as a metaphor for people's helplessness. And we do need to understand that, you know, because you look at things that are genuinely popular in the world of politics, which are sending the present establishment absolutely nuts in a tailspin. Not least, for instance, how popular healthcare is in America, and how I absolutely guarantee right now that if the Democrats do not pick a leadership candidate who is completely committed, so in other words, Bernie Sanders, who's completely committed to this, to healthcare, to improving people's working lives, to getting more money into the hands of the people who need it rather than further off, if not actually challenging the whole capitalist system as itself, which has become a complete failure without any argument now, I think it's pretty obvious, you will get a second term of Trump. Simple as that. You will not win. And in, you know, in this country, another example, again, just harking back quickly to something you said earlier on, in the middle of an election campaign 2017, if anyone who works within that realm had been asked, they would have said to Jeremy Corbyn, whatever you do, don't point out after a terrorist attack in this country in the middle of an election campaign that we really need to look at our foreign policy and how it backfires onto this country. Well, sure enough, he did that. And was it political suicide? No, because actually he jumped in the polls. Yeah. You know, because people were looking at it and going, yeah, you're right, our foreign policy is shit. And yeah, I mean, it's weird how certain things, more than one thing can be true at any given time. Again, this is a funny thing people seem to struggle. They have very, very like bipolar attitudes about the world. You know, I mean, and again, coming back to what we said earlier on, you know, is this idea of completely condemning the IRA, for instance, and their actions while meeting them in private to talk about what they were doing. Well, every prime minister has pretty much has done that we know of since the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, and some other MPs in between. You know, the idea that people cannot be interested in, say, a country's foreign policy as a major election issue is true. Equally, people are more interested in it than you realise. And then, and in the same way that people, and I'll be the first to say, because I always, you know, kick my own side, I don't, you know, I am a very committed left-wing person, but I don't have this this ridiculous kind of vision that many socialists, or particularly in socialist worker types, have of the noble working man. No, you know what? We're some ignorant bastards, mate. We really are. You know, some of us voted for Maggie. You know, the working class has got just as many moronic scumbags in it as anywhere else. But that doesn't mean that we don't have wonderful people and the best culture in the world too. And it doesn't mean we all deserve to be treated like crap. You know what I mean? I think I've tied a very long tail onto this kite. And I can't actually quite remember where we started.
Yeah, I just look, just to go, absolutely, John. And you mentioned pubs, for example. So we look at the two of the most famous programs this country has in viewership, EastEnders and Coronation Street, where a lot of the drama and a lot of the stories were based in pubs. Those two shows were based in pubs. We used to laugh at EastEnders in the 80s because. we used to say that's the only pub where black and white people are drinking together, but we still watched it because we thought it was funny, you know. Weren't
do you
real.
Remember the do you remember the episode where they had like a little BMP contingent? I think this was like the early 90s.
They
came into the pub and someone hands Sanjay a leaflet, and no, he hands it to Mark Fowler while he's talking to Sanjay, and he doesn't look at it, and Sanjay's like really pissed off that he's taking the leaflet.
Well, I thought Nick Cotton was you know, I thought he was really. We used to laugh at Nick Cotton when he went to Ali. One of the first episodes, Ali, we owned the cafe, trying to start the car and it wouldn't start.
Yeah.
And Nick Cotton leaning through the window going, "It won't start, you stupid Turk." But I thought it was funny. I think the media wanted him. It was the first time we'd seen, or the public had seen Nick Cotton, and they just wanted him to say something offensive so we know he's a bad villain, you know, he's a baddie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and it's not a good, in, as far as drama is concerned, it's not a good, trope is not the word I'm thinking of here, but a kind of, it's a narrative device, isn't it? How can I make this bloke look like he's the baddie? Oh, I don't know. We'll instantly make him a bastard to ethnic minorities, which is definitely makes him the baddie, but equally in some ways, like you say, makes some people just go, "Oh, that's quite funny."
I don't think we were offended. We were offended. You know, we just found that sort of thing funny. And I think sometimes we've got to laugh at things and not take things seriously. And everything.
It depends on the effect it has on your wider life.
I'm from an era that unless someone actually attacks me physically because of my colour, then it's not funny. Then we're real.
But then again, you say,
or I'm running away.
Yeah, when they're coming after me with an axe. No, I mean, I'm very much into no platforming, especially now because we've put ourselves into a world where extremism is becoming more and more acceptable within the mainstream. All for the benefit of basically a bunch of, you know, middle class tossers who think that the epitome of free speech is allowing race haters a platform. Not so keen on allowing somebody from ISIS, for instance, or something like that. But as long as they're a white, you know, supremacist, they're welcome on stage. And I completely disagree. Those viewpoints are unacceptable. But the point is, that is the real world. And yes, we do have to take account of the world of entertainment. We all have our own hate. You know, I mean, I personally hate Pharrell Williams for a number of reasons. But he and Robin Thicke and their song Blurred Lines. Yeah, I don't like that song. I do think it's a bit rapey, as one person described it. I think the lyrics are a bit twisted and sick. And it has an effect with that kind of stuff. Culture does have an effect on what we do. That is absolutely true, but it also has a limited effect up to a point. And that point, the cutoff point normally is exactly, you know, how does it work? In real life, if our politics was good, if society didn't have racism like it does now, if politicians of various types didn't fall back on anti-ethnic or racist or anti-immigration rhetoric, then a bloke, as you say, like Nick Cotton doing that in the show, nobody would notice because it wouldn't matter because we're all living the lives of kind of decency and equality that we deserve to live and go, "Oh yeah, there's some dickhead on the telly saying something. Oh, fuck him. It doesn't matter." Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think the media, I mean, there was always an element of baddies in when I was growing up in programs. And Gripper from Grange Hill was well known racist, still saying racist things because they needed him to say those things because it is the baddie here. Look, he's talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas in schools, when I was in my school, we had loads of them, you know, and we fought them every day, you know, give them a whack, get a whack back, and off to school, fight, punch each other, and then now they're all rusters, so that's why I find it funny, you know, it's just, but as I said, what I'm saying, I can understand how people feel, because they feel they're being stifled, and then the press add a dose of fear, but just on the age of Britishness, and the age of a certain age aren't listening to things that normally we grew up with, and they're not listening to it anymore because it doesn't. But it's odd that two of the most progressive socialists, Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, they're over 60. Yeah. And I wonder if someone younger would have done it or brave enough to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because I think people are coming to a greater awareness now, and I think newer generations. You see, again, if you look at the politicians from the centre or further right who are aghast at firstly aghast at the idea that anyone could not like them, and secondly that you know, anyone could not look at their presentation and think, "Oh, even though this has got absolutely nothing behind it, I think you're wonderful," but that they could be attracted to socialism. Well, you know, try the Iraq War, try the economic crisis from 2008 onwards. Try looking at what's happened in Libya, and it's still going on now, in other places where Britain and America intervened. Try looking at what's happening in Yemen. You know, why would anyone like a, say, pro-working class, pro-equality, anti-interventionist foreign policy type of government idea. Oh, I wonder why. You don't think it could possibly be your fault, do you? And then you also, that immediately keys into another one of the big problems I have, which I could really make, we could do like four shows in a row with me talking about this, which is the deficit of taking responsibility. And again, this is a highly loaded concept because so many people will say, oh yes, there's a lack of responsibility in society from the young, from the poor, from single mothers, from all these other people who are easy to bash. No, actually, majority of it comes from the powerful. And it comes from, as I say, the middle class and upwards who fetishize the notion of free speech. And mean that means we should give extremist racist haters who one way or another promote violence a platform just for the sake of being free and noble and standing up for a society that we all think is decent, but none of us actually live in because it doesn't exist. And it comes from, you know, rich people, and it comes from politicians, and it comes from all these people going, well, even though I've made this decision and I've been central to the carrying out of this decision by government policy, it's not my fault when everything goes to shit. So when people die because they've had to make a choice between the drugs they need to live on and the food that they can't afford to buy because their benefits have been cut and they're being forced into work that they can't handle because they're disabled, that's not my fault, even though I voted for every one of those things to happen. But you can't bring it down to me.
Yeah, I sometimes look at some decisions by governments. If I took Reaganomics and put it now, where politics is now, I don't think he could get away with it. I don't think he could pull off the stuff that he did as with the government of the 80s here. I just think they'd get slaughtered in the social media. I think there'd be films about it. I think there'd be massive documentaries on more left-wing forums now, and they'd be slaughtered for it. And I don't think the current administration in the UK and the current administration in America, I don't think they're equipped for it. I think they're not that experienced, and I don't think anyone's experienced for that. And we're all playing catch-up. There was an interview with Gordon Brown, and he was asked the question, would he come back? He goes, A, I think people just get fed up with seeing the same face. And he said, B, I couldn't cope with the social media now.
No.
He said, I couldn't cope with it. It's a different... He wouldn't know what angle to come from on it. So we are rich, but it's interesting, and we'll do another show at some point about it, because I remember in the late 80s or 1987-88, and I don't think they've ever been beaten for, and it was a very brave thing by CBS Records or Columbia Records to sign up a group like Public Enemy. Ooh. Who I don't think they will be beaten in regards to the effect they had on black youth in America and the UK and the messages they were telling about black history. Mm-hmm. And corporations and how they... maybe I was at that age where I was impressionable. And maybe the age now people are in, that age where they're impressionable. You know when you soak up all this information, you're a sponge. So...
Yeah,
you know, I'll never forget Public Enemy. You know, and we all spoke about it. When God, did you hear what Chuck D said? Elvis didn't mean shit to me.
Yeah,
and I think by politicians coming on now and saying, "Look, you can't get a job, right? Yeah, I can't get a job. Or your skin all the time. Yeah, you can't get a house. No. You feel demeaned when you go into the job centre, or you've been sanctioned. You've got nowhere to go in the evenings. You've got no, you know, and that's maybe it's just reaching out to people with the right things, because I don't think, I'll say it again, I don't think politics has spoke to anyone in my time. I don't think they really spoke to people. I don't think.
Oh, yeah.
I really don't think. I think they've just looked at some film on the telly when they come on, or it's a part of the news where you go and make the tea. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah, no, completely, mate. I think you're quite right. But also, I mean, again, that's something that with the kind of 97 nostalgia generation of politicians and their supporters now, the centrist, you know, they just can't understand that somebody like Jeremy Corbyn would say something that would resonate with people, like you're living in an unfair society, 0 hours of contracts are unacceptable, you deserve better than this. And they're like, you know, how can this man possibly be popular to these people?
Firmly believe that politics got to the point where it was arrogant. And it was almost like it got to the point where it was arrogant. It was arrogant on decisions for referendums. It was arrogant on general elections. It was arrogant on austerity. And I think it got to the point, and certainly 2017, you'll probably see this more and more, kids, is that the electorate will punish you. And I think you're going to see it more and more. I think the electorate punished America with Trump.
But yeah, there was an element of the fact that people were sick of the system. I mean, it's been pointed out by smarter people than me, but I will reiterate some of it. Trump talked about jobs. Yeah, it was bullshit. And that bloke couldn't, you know, and you know, job creators, oh, fuck off. You know, that bloke couldn't do that if his life depended on it. But yeah, he talked about work. He said, hey, you're not getting a good deal. He said, hey, NAFTA's a bad deal. Now, NAFTA is a far, far worse deal for Mexico than it ever was for America. So there is a part of me that when I hear an American say that, I think, oh, do me a favour, mate. You know, but at the same time, yeah, NAFTA was a shit deal.
Yeah, but look look at his opponent, John. She was
she's awful.
She was a Democratic Party. I don't even know what she was saying, John. And people opened up the newspapers and saw that the Democratic Party had pumped $1 billion into California for advertising campaign. You tell someone, they don't like Clinton, Hillary. I don't know what she says. I didn't even know what she was talking about. It's so middle. And then they also read on the next page, this non-entity that we want you to vote for, by the way.
Yeah.
Her party's just put $1 billion into advertising campaign in California. See ya. Yeah. I'm just not going to vote.
And not bothered going to so many of the other states where they thought, oh, don't worry, we're quids in there. They always vote Democrat. We don't need to campaign there.
Where was Missouri? This is an interesting point. Missouri, well, the most southern part of America you could get, traditional Republican.
Yeah.
They voted for Bernie.
Exactly. Because
he was hitting these pockets. He was hitting pockets of poverty. Yeah. And just campaigning. Big style. We're going to close. I do hope you enjoyed this chat, listeners, and more of it to come. John, closing thoughts.
Firstly, a little bit of front advertising. The reason we're pre-recording this week is because I'm going to be at an event at Houseman's Bookshop this Wednesday, the time that you'll be hearing this live, because a fellow has written a book called Chav Solidarity, which sounds really fascinating to me. I don't particularly like that word, but in the context of the book it's about, I think it's fair. So I'm going to go and check that out. Next week I should hopefully have my show written about, again, some of the ideas that we talked about this week, which was racism and intolerance and Islamophobia, and basically what we do about it, because what we're doing now isn't good enough. Closing thoughts. Ultimately, you're not forced to change a part of who you are or anything. All people are asking you to do is to accept it. You have to accept the fact that, different people find different things interesting, attractive, and some of it will be against your taste. For the life of me, I have no idea how Ed Sheeran has sold so many records, but nevertheless, that's my taste, because I'm an old geezer, hip hop, punk, etc. stuff. That's my thing. Equally, I understand that, as you said, Dave, it's hard to do anything new now when you have the impact of somebody like Chuck D, and more importantly, when the system that he was fighting against has adapted to ways of co-opting a lot of that. I mean, God knows punk was co-opted almost as quickly as it was born. And it's a bit of a cliche, but I still like the bands I like. That's my fallback position of culture is to music, because it happens to be something I'm interested in. There's plenty of other examples. You can't continue to have the, we don't live in a society where there is no alternative. There's plenty of alternatives. Now more than ever, we need to have one, because we're facing climate catastrophe and we're facing the complete breakdown of the economic system, which is well, well beyond its use and its practical capabilities, and we need to change it. And, you need to give people an opportunity to actually have some kind of future. Stop shutting them out because they're working class, and stop shutting them out, because they hold left-wing opinions that frighten you. And there's more important things in life than how much tax you have to pay, my bourgeois comrades. So, yeah, I guess that's it, Dave. Thanks again. I'll see you next week.
Cheers, John. Thanks very much.
No problem.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.